Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on a series of fights at Southlake Mall this week since its reopening. Governor Eric Holcomb's Back on Track plan has Indiana moving into phase three this weekend. Eric Weddle reports all Indiana teachers collectively won the 2021 Teacher of the Year Award. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with infectious disease specialist Dr. Erica Kaufman West. Franciscan Health recently took part in a national study of convalescent plasma to treat COVID-19. All of that and more on this special edition of Lakeshore Update. There were a series of fights that happened at Southlake Mall this week since it reopened on Monday. Those fights included one that led to arrests, one that led to a police call without charges, and then another that police were not called to. A viral video of one of the brawls surfaced on social media showing multiple people hitting, kicking, and pushing each other. A shopper who goes by the name Tay Monet Simpson was at Southlake Mall on Wednesday when she saw a fight between multiple people break out outside of a store and then disperse. She took a video and posted it on Facebook, which has since been shared more than 2,000 times as of Thursday evening. Hobart police did not have a record of the fight on Wednesday, but do have two other police reports of the fights that happened earlier this week. Four women were arrested following a fight in the mall on Tuesday where a woman was allegedly attacked. Those arrested included three Chicago women and one Hammond woman who faced possible charges including theft, possession of marijuana, as well as battery and disorderly conduct. Hobart Police Captain James Gonzalez says the women were transported to the Lake County Jail and charges were forwarded to the Lake County Prosecutor's Office. The identities and mugshots of the women are being withheld pending formal criminal charges being filed. Captain Gonzalez said at this time, Hobart police officers are scheduled to work shifts at the mall on Friday evenings as well as Saturdays for now.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Indiana is moving forward early to the next stage of its plan to relax COVID-19 restrictions. Stage 3 of the governor's Back on Track plan began Friday for all but three counties statewide. That next stage, originally set to begin May 24th, allows gyms, fitness centers, community pools, campgrounds, playgrounds, and tennis and basketball courts to open within social distancing restrictions and sanitation guidelines. Governor Eric Holcomb says the early transition is possible because he says most Hoosiers have continued to follow wearing masks, social distancing, and hand washing recommendations.
If you are 65 and older, or if you have underlying health conditions, we're still telling you to be uber cautious.
Stage 3 also allows gatherings of up to 100 people, which State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box acknowledges she's concerned about.
However, I do think that there is a way that we can do this safely, and that involves all of the same things that we've already been doing.
Box encourages groups of that size to be outdoors. Lake, Marion, and Cass counties cannot begin Stage 3 until June 1st.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Indiana expects to collect less money from the state lottery this fiscal year than it budgeted for. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the projected shortfall isn't as bad as some state officials feared.
IGT Indiana is the private company that runs the lottery for the state. General Manager Melissa Pursley says it's hard to estimate COVID-19's impact.
It is evident that COVID-19 will have an impact on the Hoosier Lottery's business, including sales performance and net income return to the state. But what's less clear is how long that impact will last.
Yet the lottery had its best sales month ever in April. And while projections say the state won't get as much money at the end of the fiscal year as planned, it's only about $10 million less than expected. Lottery Commission member David Redden says he's surprised.
Even though it's a shortfall, it could be a lot worse.
The lottery will likely report its final revenue numbers in August. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Families whose children receive free or reduced lunch at school will start receiving additional SNAP benefits or food stamps this week. It's aimed at helping cover the cost of meals families may not have received from their child's school during the COVID-19 outbreak. According to the state's Family and Social Services Administration, about 600,000 children qualify for the pandemic-related benefit. Families will receive the daily cost of school meals multiplied by the average number of days missed since school buildings closed. That's about $320 in benefits for each child who qualifies. Families who do not otherwise receive SNAP benefits will receive a new card in the mail. Others will have the additional benefits applied to their existing cards by the end of May.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says Indiana cannot test every nursing home resident and employee by next week, as the White House recommends. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Box recently addressed questions about long-term care facilities across the state.
The state has repeatedly been pressured to release the names of long-term care facilities that have positive COVID-19 cases, but state officials refuse to do so. Dr. Chris Box insists she's not trying to protect anyone by shielding the information.
What I am trying to do is emphasize the importance of that communication occurring between the facility with the residents and with their representatives.
She also says it's simply not possible to test every nursing home patient anytime soon, citing the large number of tests that would be required. But Box does say the state is working to get every employee tested.
Either connect them with Optum sites or to actually do that testing in the facilities for them, or to be able to provide them with the test kits.
Box says she's hoping to get every long-term care facility employee tested by mid-June. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Chamber of Commerce says it's disappointed the governor's office has not decided to implement a work-share program. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports it's a common system in other states that lets workers keep jobs while accessing some unemployment benefits.
Work-share programs allow companies to have employees work reduced hours, while the unemployment system supplements most of the difference in their pay. 28 states have work share programs, some starting during the pandemic. The Federal CARES Act would pay for 50% of benefits and some administrative costs of starting a temporary one. Kevin Brenniger is the president and CEO of the Indiana Chamber. He says 130 companies have asked them why a work share program isn't available in Indiana.
It's been very important to them during this pandemic, and they're frustrated that they can't have access to work share here in Indiana.
Governor Eric Holcomb said his office has researched system upgrades and whether there was legislative support, but it has no immediate plans to start a program. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
After 6 weeks of steep declines, the number of people filing new claims for unemployment benefits in Indiana remained largely unchanged last week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports that's based on data released Thursday from the Department of Labor.
Last week, about 30,000 Hoosiers applied for unemployment benefits. That's only about 400 fewer people than the week before. That's in contrast to previous weeks, when the number of people applying for benefits dropped by more than 10,000. Experts say that even though many workplaces are being allowed to reopen, there's still a significant drop in economic demand due to COVID-19. That might be exacerbated by new layoffs as paycheck protection loans run out for some businesses. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
All Indiana teachers collectively won the 2021 Teacher of the Year Award. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports the decision from the State Education Department came as teachers face their most challenging year.
For more than 60 years, the Indiana Department of Education picked a single educator to recognize as Teacher of the Year. Those who won showed excellence in the classroom and went above and beyond to help their students. State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick says all teachers have done that and more in response to school building closures and the pandemic.
We had teachers going beyond the call of duty to help with food, to have parades. They were calling students every day, taking care of social emotional needs. It was way beyond the academic piece.
Traditionally, school districts nominate their top teacher to the state level. The statewide winner takes part in programs and represents Indiana educators and advances to the national competition. Teachers that were nominated this year will be considered again for next year's honor. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Four Indianapolis residents have filed a lawsuit trying to get Attorney General Curtis Hill permanently ousted from his position. The complaint, filed in Marion County, wants the Supreme Court to answer a question it refused to address earlier this week, whether the 30-day suspension of Hill's law license creates a vacancy in the office. If it does, state law says Governor Eric Holcomb gets to appoint Hill's successor, likely meaning Hill won't be able to return to his post after the 30 days are up. Holcomb asked the Supreme Court that very question in the wake of Hill's suspension, but the court said Holcomb wasn't following proper legal procedure. One of the four people named in the lawsuit is Julia Vaughn, who heads the citizen advocacy group Common Cause Indiana.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Doctors have high rates of burnout, depression, and suicide. But there's a less understood emotion they also struggle with, guilt. Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis reports on how the COVID-19 pandemic has complicated those feelings.
About 20 or so women were gathered for a late afternoon video conference. Some had glasses of wine or cups of coffee. It was March 26th when COVID-19 cases were beginning to ramp up in Indiana. One of the women, Dr. Teresa Rohr Kirchgraber, posed a question. Was anyone else feeling guilty?
And I kind of figured that if I was feeling that way, I'm sure a couple of others were. Maybe giving voice to it would help me address it in some way and help to take away a little bit of the pain.
The Zoom session was a wellness meeting for women faculty at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Since the start of the pandemic, the group has gathered virtually to check in and provide emotional support. Rohr Kirchgraber's feelings of guilt resonated with another woman in the meeting, Dr. Cindy Brown.
I was really, for several weeks, having a lot of trouble sleeping.
Brown treats patients with cystic fibrosis, a genetic disorder that affects the lungs. Rohr Kirchgraber works with adolescents with eating disorders. Both provide virtual care, but neither works with COVID-19 patients on what's being called the front lines of the pandemic. And that makes them feel guilty. Rohr Kirchgraber knows her work is important, but she sometimes feels like a fraud.
You know, you're getting a lot of comments from friends and neighbors, oh, good for you, take care, front lines, and I have to kind of go, thanks.
Guilt is a common feeling among physicians, but it's not well studied. That's according to Dr. Lawrence Blum, a Philadelphia-based psychiatrist and psychoanalyst who has written about doctors' guilt and treated them for years.
It's almost like a pre-existing condition that now is exacerbated by the current situation with the COVID-19 pandemic.
In his practice, Blum found guilt causes doctors to hold themselves to unrealistic standards, standards they can't meet while treating COVID-19, a disease they've never experienced.
They're used to saving people. And most patients, there's a lot of stuff they can do for them. And now many of them are in a circumstance where they're inundated with really sick patients and there's sometimes nothing they can do for them.
The guilt is more complex for doctors who don't see COVID-19 patients. Dr. Catherine Gold works in family medicine and researches physician mental health at the University of Michigan. She compares it to the survivor's guilt someone might feel after a natural disaster.
One of the most important components is that you feel very connected to the other people. So maybe there's a tornado that hits in your neighborhood, so you think, oh, it could have been me.
Gold says physicians feel connected that way. They share values and have similar training. Gold has heard her own colleagues who don't treat COVID-19 patients echo feelings of helplessness and guilt for not being on the front lines.
You kind of want to protect people who are, you see as similar, and you can't do that.
That was Brown's experience too. A friend directs an intensive care unit in New York City, where between mid-March and late April, hundreds of people were dying of COVID-19 every day. Brown wanted to know how he was doing, but was nervous to email him. She knew he was busy. Her friend wrote back and said he was tired, but healthy. And he asked Brown how she was doing.
I actually told him I do feel guilty for not being and doing more. And he was the one who told me, please don't feel guilty. I'm happy that you're not having to be part of this.
Brown said that alleviated some of her guilt, and the wellness meetings with IU's med school faculty created a safe space for the women to share their feelings. Roar Kirchgraber says women in science and medicine might feel more guilty than their male colleagues.
In general, women have a tendency to just put more on their plate and then feel less satisfied because it's harder to do everything super well.
She, Brown, and a group of the Indiana doctors have also discussed their feelings of guilt in an essay published on the physician blog, Kevin MD.
You know, some folks said, you know, how grateful they were that we put this out there because this is what they've been thinking and they thought they were the only ones.
The doctors say they have to remember their work is still meaningful for their patients. Lauren Bavis, Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Dr. Erica Kaufman West, infectious disease specialist for Franciscan Health.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Franciscan Health is working in a national study that is being spearheaded by the Mayo Clinic to look into how effective what is called convalescent plasma is in trying to treat patients who've been infected with COVID-19. We have with us Dr. Erica Kaufman West, who's the infectious disease specialist for Franciscan Health, to talk about it. And Dr. Kaufman West, thank you for being with us today.
You're quite welcome.
Well, first, for people that do not know what convalescent plasma is, how important is it, especially in these days with COVID-19?
Our plasma in general is filled with antibodies and other valuable proteins that our body creates in order to fight off various illnesses that we come in contact with. The notion of convalescent plasma is not a new one. It's been around for a couple hundred years, and the idea is if you take someone's antibodies that's already been exposed to a disease and give them to somebody who's suffering from that disease, that those antibodies can neutralize the infection while that allowing that person to recover faster.
Mm-hmm. Now, does the FDA recognize convalescent plasma as something that can help? Maybe, I guess, part of it is to see if it will probably work in this instance, but probably in other infectious instances too?
This particular study did get, did go through the FDA as a sort of a new investigational treatment. Mm-hmm. So the FDA is aware of the notion of convalescent plasma. Up until this point, this is, to my knowledge, the largest sort of single registry looking at convalescent plasma. Up until now, it had sort of been smaller, you know, individualized institutions sort of doing their own little pieces to mm-hmm. see if this might work against other viruses, you know, such as H1N1 in the past or the, you know, first SARS epidemic in the early 2000s. So it's not a new notion to the FDA, but this sort of grand scale is definitely new.
Now, we should mention that the point is that if you have gone through being a patient or at least having received a treatment of some type, or if you have actually contracted COVID-19 and you've recovered from it, you've got, of course, the antibodies in your body, I guess, that will certainly show themselves eventually. But the plasma is still good. And in fact, any blood that is received is still going to be good. We'll talk about on how to be able to donate plasma in just a moment, but what are the ways that taking advantage of this plasma are to researchers like yourselves and others working on this particular project to see if it will indeed do what you hope it will?
Yeah, so I mean, there's so many questions that this can help us answer. The first question, obviously, is can antibodies to the SARS-CoV-2 virus, can antibodies to that virus neutralize the virus? And that's something that we all hope is the case. That would lead us to believe there's some sort of immunity that one would get from having been infected by the virus. So, I mean, that'll be the first question is can these antibodies neutralize the virus?
Mm-hmm.
The second question is what does that mean? Does it help people to avoid those severe cases, you know, keep people off the ventilator, keep people from dying? Does it decrease the length of time that they're suffering from their illness? So do they get out of the hospital faster? Are they back to their typical routines faster? And then the question will be, you know, at what point is this treatment best given? Is it best given in the first 72 hours? Can it still be effective after 2 or 3 weeks of illness? And then who benefits most? Is it young people, old people, people of different races or genders? Is it more effective if you've got comorbidities, for example? Or are those people the ones that are going to benefit most? So the benefit of a study this size is you'll have the sort of diversity of patients to be able to look at all of those factors and say, okay, who in the future would we prioritize this therapy to? Obviously, we are very much indebted to folks who are generous enough to donate their plasma.
Mm-hmm.
So at least at this point, this is not something that we can just make in a lab and pump out and just create as many doses as we want.
Well.
So knowing that there will be a limited supply, you know, who is going to be benefiting most from it, that is hopefully questions that will be answered.
Now, obviously, getting the plasma from one's blood system starts out with donating blood. What is the difference, by the way, for folks that may not be familiar with just donating blood at the blood center and the plasma being taken about and used in this particular project?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you donate blood, you donate everything. You donate your platelets, your plasma, your red blood cells, the whole thing. We typically think of blood donation as being a red blood cell donation, and that's the majority of what is used and what benefits people.
Mm-hmm.
But all of those other components of the blood are sort of pooled together and can be used as needed. When you're talking about donating plasma, the red blood cells are given back to the donor and just the plasma is taken. So the idea is similar. It takes a little bit longer because they, you know, have to give you your red blood cells back. But if you've ever given blood before, it won't be that different of an experience.
I see. What's in this case, this any special requirements that you have to follow, aside from the usual ones for donating blood?
Mm-hmm. No, just the usual ones of donating blood. You have to obviously know that you were infected with SARS-CoV-2. So obviously in this case, when we're talking about plasma donation, we want people that have antibodies. So you have to have had a test that's positive at least 14 days prior. You have to be feeling well. We don't want anybody that's sick coming in. You have to be feeling well and at least 14 days past the date of your test. And then just the general, you know, standard blood donation requirements. Obviously stay hydrated on the day of your donation, just like you would with a regular blood cell.
Now, I know that Versiti is the Franciscan Health's blood supplier, so I'm guessing that you'd have to get in touch with them to set up an appointment to be able to donate?
Yes, that's exactly right. Versiti has on their website a whole lot of information about donating plasma and what it takes and how to do that. The Franciscan website, I'm sure you'll be able to get that information to folks, has a step-by-step process so that we can, especially if you've gotten your COVID test with us, we'll be able to help validate that with Versiti and make it even easier for you to get to the donation center. Mm-hmm.
When did Franciscan Health get involved in this national study working with the Mayo Clinic, and how long does the study run?
Well, we probably got started about 4 weeks ago or so, and the took some time, obviously, to get through the protocols and everything, and to get physicians signed up. We all have to, you know, do particular training to be able to do this. So we've been probably able to do the donations now for about the last two and a half weeks. How long will it run sort of depends on what the Mayo Clinic finds. So they did an initial analysis for safety, and they found that there were no increased adverse events or anything that would cause them to stop the study early. I don't know that they have a predefined, you know, number of patients that where they would stop the study. My understanding is that they'll continue to enroll and analyze the data at a certain point to see if they can answer some of those questions that we went through already.
Dr. Erica Coffin-West is an infectious disease specialist for Franciscan Health here in Northwest Indiana. And thank you very much, Dr. Coffin-West, for the information. And we hope that folks donate their blood and are able to take advantage of this national study to find out what benefits the convalescent plasma might have in dealing with COVID-19.
Thank you, and thanks for highlighting our important work.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.